No high school students we generally have, so I won't tell you about our national award-winning program.
What is that, Chief?
Since you asked. in which high school students come. But we do have Judge Schutzen, who will be at all the hearings today with his University of Wisconsin trial and advocacy class. Would the students please rise as well as Judge Schutzen?
We only have a few this morning. We expect to have all of them this afternoon.
Yeah, there'll be no seats. That's it. Can't have everything, right? Good. Thank you for coming, Judge Schutzen, and thank you for coming. And we shall proceed to our first case, 02-1056, State versus Sean D. Schulpius. We start with Ms. Hennick, representing Mr. Schulpius, Ms. Hennick is Assistant State Public Defender. Let me say that arrangements were supposed to have been made so that this oral argument would be available to Mr. Schulpius via a telephone connection. Is that that has been done? Because he has no access to the internet to hear it, so that is done. Okay. Ms. Hennick.
Thank you very much. May it please the Court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent the petitioner, Sean Schulpius. For more than 4 years, Sean Schulpius was ordered placed on supervised release under Chapter 980, but was not placed. In the 10 years since Chapter 980, the sexually violent person statute has been passed and been effective. No one has been placed on an approved supervised release placement in Milwaukee County. The issue before this court today is whether the failure to place someone who has been found dangerous enough to be considered a sexually violent person, but not dangerous enough to require the medium or maximum, depending on the circumstances, confinement of either Wisconsin Resource Center or Sandridge, can make this statute, as applied, unconstitutional for its failure to give substantive due process.
Counselor, was there ever a petition for mandamus filed on Mr. Schulpius's behalf to force his release?
He never filed a petition for mandamus. What he did do was move for contempt.
Okay.
There was, in the contempt, there was one contempt order actually entered. That was entered and required then-Secretary Leanne to ask the legislature for authority to build something in which Mr. Schulpius could be housed. The problem with mandamus would have been that he clearly had a right to supervised release. From a legal perspective, however, the statute called for a placement plan. And the problem was that those plans were not being developed. It is not clear, and I suspect mandamus would not have been effective in this situation.
Counsel, just a question on that. The as applied, now is Schulpius, is he actually alleging that the statute was unconstitutional as far as himself, or is he saying here that the complaint with a complaint that the statute was not applied at all? In other words, is it directed toward himself, or was the statute not used here at all?
This is a tricky case, and it's somewhat in between, and that's what makes it difficult. Yeah. He is – parts of the statute clearly were applied to him. The entire statute was not applied to him. Although everybody assumed they were proceeding under its provisions. Therefore, I think it fits better on the analysis that as applied to him, because certain provisions could not be activated, it is unconstitutional. It is true that if the statute had been followed as enacted, It is true there would have been no problem here. You would have had Mr. Shulpius placed. He would have been in a proper placement. He would have been on supervised release. If there were a problem with that, he could have been revoked. But that's where we stand. We're beyond exactly what the statute initially contemplated.
Ms. Hennig, my question, I guess, is the remedy that you're asking for, and I'm having some trouble understanding how you get to what I understand you're requesting. I understand that you want an outright release, an immediate release of your client. And apparently you want that despite the fact that Judge Franke vacated his order, which had required the supervised release, ordered that he be held in a secure facility. And it's my understanding that Judge D'Amato put his approval on that same process. How do you get to now asking for an immediate release of your client?
Okay. This is going to take a couple of steps. Yeah,
I want to hear this.
Okay. As an initial matter, if a statute is unconstitutional, you cannot apply it. If you do not apply it, what you get to is release. If you look at it in a slightly different way, there was an assumption in your question.
Let me stop you there. So your requested remedy depends on a finding by this Court that Chapter 980 is unconstitutional?
As applied to Mr. Shulpius.
Could you restate that then? Because the way that you responded, I heard you to suggest that it was almost a facial challenge rather than an as-applied. So go through that first step again.
If I did that, I misspoke. If a statute is unconstitutional as applied, that statute cannot be applied to the person involved because to do so is unconstitutional. If that statute is not applied to Mr. Shulpius, then Mr. Shulpius cannot be held and should be released.
Okay, and the burden is still unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, correct? That is the...
If this were a facial challenge, and I would say that even as an applied challenge, I would be willing to say that you can meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. However, because it is an as-applied challenge, you cannot presume that the situation is constitutional. And what that means here is that up until this point, when faced with this statute, this Court has made certain assumptions. In essence, what this Court has done up until this point, when dealing with the whole statute, is to say, as you do in some other circumstances, we will take any niggling doubts and resolve them in the State's benefit. Now that we are in an as-applied challenge, where there is no presumption of constitutionality, I believe this Court can no longer do that. In other words, this Court cannot presume that, as applied to Mr. Shulpius, treatment is really what's at issue here. And the reason that it cannot assume that is because the holding of Mr. Shulpius in Wisconsin Resource Center, or subsequently in Sandridge, is not linked to anything having to do with treatment or, for that matter, protection, because what you had was the judge saying, look, this man is not so dangerous that he needs to be placed in that setting.
What you're saying is that is history in the sense that the finding of two judges, Franke and D'Amato, is that this person is dangerous. And that's the present finding that I understand is still there. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted, that is what I understand is.
But that brings us to the second part of this argument. That brings us to our challenge to what Judge Franke did. That brings us to whether it is very clear that Judge Franke, under your decision in Morford, proceeded incorrectly in removing Mr. Shulpius from supervised release. Under Morford, it is quite clear that the proceeding should have happened under 980.08. They did not. That brings us to the question of whether, with this case pending on appeal, that Morford decision applies to this case, and we contend that it does.
But suppose it doesn't, then do you lose?
No, I don't believe that we do. I believe that you still have a situation. First of all, it is not clear to me that what the court said below was that he's now dangerous and needs to be placed. If you look at the language of the order of Judge Franke, and
which order are we talking about now?
This is the November 29th, 2002, I'm sorry, 2000 order. It reads, it is ordered that Sean Shopius be committed to institutional care, and the last part of it reads, still subject, however, to the decision and order requiring release entered in this case on October 27, 1999. It is also clear from the December 1st letter written by Judge Franke that same year that he could not sign a straight-out order to place Mr. Shopius because doing so was, in his words, inconsistent with the release of the respondent, Mr. Shopius, which I ordered on October 27th. It is clear that Judge Franke saw these as two different pieces, and I believe that this Court has to see them as two different pieces as well.
Strikes me that as to your first argument, you are saying, in effect, and maybe you're not, that the order was to release him.
Yes, the order was to release
him. Supervised release.
Yes.
He was held for a lengthy time period, not on supervisory release, but in custody, maximum custody. And that was unconstitutional as applied to him because it violated the very terms of the statute.
Yes.
And that everything that came thereafter is sort of irrelevant because
yes.
he was being held invalidly and therefore they had no jurisdiction over him.
Yes.
Now, your second argument is that they didn't have jurisdiction because Morford applies, but you don't need Morford.
I don't need Morford.
It's a nice touch.
It helps.
Okay. Just wanted to make it clear. So that's what you're really fighting about. And so all the orders after he wasn't released, as ordered by the court.
Yes, and I believe that there is a way that this court could write an opinion that it would never reach Morford.
Okay. Tell us how.
If
I don't guarantee that, of course.
Of course not. If this court says that what you had going here were two different orders, which is the position that Mr. Shopius was in after this appeal came back down the first time, then you've got one order that says he should be released because it is unconstitutional as applied to him. That order was not put in effect after it was made because it had been stayed. You also had an order saying that we are not revoking, because it was done as a reconsidering his supervised release, and therefore he should be in the Wisconsin Resource Center. Interestingly enough, there really is no order actually written and entered that directly does that. The assumption is that that non-final, somewhat ambiguous November 29th, 2000 order does that.
Ms. Hennig, I don't think we ever really got fully finished with my questions. And if I can, I'd like to come back just a little bit. You told us that if it's unconstitutional as applied, the statute, to your client, then he can't be held and must be released. My problem with that is that the U.S. Supreme Court has looked at statutes similar to 980, statutes that did not have supervised release provisions, and found those statutes constitutional. Now, that being the case, I'm having trouble with your argument that because in this situation there could be supervised release, but it wasn't possible, he didn't get released, now he must be outright released. And that's what you're saying. You're not saying that you want supervised release for him. As I understand it, you're saying he now should be immediately released. Is that not correct?
That is correct. We certainly would not accept supervised release, assuming he would actually be placed. Because if you simply put him on supervised release, we go back into the same circle because no one in Milwaukee County has been
placed. But how do you get to this unconstitutionality conclusion, given the U.S. Supreme Court case? And I can't remember if it's Kansas versus Hendricks or Kansas versus Crane. I get them mixed up. But how do you get there?
I think the way that you get there is, first of all, if you look at that case, the issue in that case was not whether there had to be supervised release. As all of us know, courts only rule on what's before them. I think the fact that they approved the statute on one ground does not suggest that if faced with another, they would rule the same way. Number two, there may very well be a difference for due process in whether the state statute actually provides for release or not. We are in a situation where it is very clear that in this state, we have supervised release. The consequences of denying supervised release where it is clearly available may very well be different than the consequences of not having it at all.
Does good faith enter into that at all? In other words, if the state was making, as it claims, good faith efforts to place your client in a supervised release setting, does that enter into the due process question?
I think that that enters into the due process question to the extent that the standard is whether what happens shocks the conscience. Having said that, we do not accept that what has happened here is good faith.
Ms. Hennick, let me just ask in a slightly different fashion. Is it your position then that if the state has a procedure and fails to follow its own procedure, that constitutes a deprivation of due process?
That can, yes, in its own, but I'm not restricting myself to that argument. Right.
Let me ask one additional question. You argued earlier that in 10 years no one has been placed in Milwaukee County. Have there been placements in other parts of the state, if the record reflects?
The record partially reflects that here. This record is quite old. There have been some placements in other parts of the state. Obviously, whatever record we have here is from before 2000.
Have any of those placements involved Milwaukee County individuals who were not placed in Milwaukee County but were placed elsewhere?
Not to my knowledge. And I don't believe this record says that. I do know that if one were to take judicial notice of other cases in the system by looking them up, there are three people currently approved for supervised release in Milwaukee County: Robert Carney, Billy Lee Morford, Samuel Post, interestingly enough. Now, two of those are Milwaukee County cases. One of those is a Dane County case, but placement is supposed to occur in Milwaukee. Mr. Carney, if you look at the court record, was approved for supervised release in November of 2002 and is still sitting at Sandridge. There is a motion similar to the motion here pending. With Mr. Post, which is Dane County case number 94CF001200, there was a supervised release order entered February 11th, 2004. Apparently, as near as I can tell from CCAP, there is currently a motion to revoke that. Billy Lee Morford, which is 96CF966242, was placed on supervised release in May of 2003. He was placed. That placement was subsequently found unsuitable. He is sitting there on temporary placement while the County of Milwaukee fights about where perhaps would be an appropriate place. I believe that there has not been good faith here with regard to Mr. Schopius, with regard to Milwaukee County. both because of the length of time that was spent spinning one's wheels and because there's been deliberate indifference to the situation.
Counsel, even if you prevail with regard to deliberate indifference to the situation, that it shocks the conscience that an order has been entered and for 4 years not followed by the state. Some people might find that offensive and might find that a violation of due process. Even if you prevail with regard to that, given the fact that there has been subsequent order and testimony and hearing, finding that he is now a sexually violent person and comply and meeting the standards set forth in the statute, why does the violation of due process for that 4-year period translate into set me free as a remedy, given his current, given the current order that he remains a sexually violent person and complies with the mandates of the statute?
For purposes of this question, are you assuming that that order is a valid order?
The order of?
The order finding he's a sexually violent person, that happened at the beginning, and that is regardless of placement. You would be found to be that either way.
I'm talking about the order that was entered by Judge Franke right before we were scheduled to have oral arguments on the case. That's the order I'm talking about.
All right. I don't believe that that order is a valid order. If I am correct that that order is not a valid order, then he is still technically on supervised release and still is not placed.
Well, let me ask you about that. If that order, your position is that Morford should have been followed, this should have gone under Chapter 980 as opposed to 80607. Is that correct?
Yes, and the standards are different.
And isn't one way that we could handle that, if we were to agree with you, would be to send it back for the appropriate hearing under 980?
If this Court is convinced, and I believe they should be, that Morford is retroactive and should have been applied here, I would prefer that this Court, if this Court were bothered, were agreed with me, let's say this Court agreed with me that it's unconstitutional and were bothered some as to remedy and did not buy my argument, I certainly would prefer that it be remanded for a correct determination whether he was still on supervised release before this Court simply says, no problem, he's not on supervised release, therefore we don't release him. Certainly I would prefer that.
And I have one other question about the 80607 proceeding that took place. Is it your position that under Morford that there never was a proceeding under 80607 under this type of case versus that the procedure changed as a result of Morford?
Absolutely. From the beginning, and I know that there's been some issue of waiver raised, but from the beginning, there was an argument about which statute should apply. There was a decision made by Judge Franke. Initially, he believed 980.08.
But my question is a little bit different. Right. My question is, did 80607 ever apply to that type of proceeding?
Our position has been from the beginning that it should not. No. And we've been consistent in that, and my position is it does not apply.
That's on the waiver issue.
Right.
There was a, was there not a motion to revoke supervised release at some point?
It was not a motion to revoke, and this is what matters for Morford. What there was a motion to reconsider. Now, no particular statute, and what you need to be careful about here is no particular statute was actually ever cited in the trial court. As the case went up, the assumption was that the proceeding was under 80607. But it was simply styled a motion to reconsider. The last time I was here on this case, one of the arguments I made, and I don't think it matters terribly, was that it wasn't 80607 because those considerations were not carefully suggested. But I think we've all just sort of assumed that that's what it was. But it really was a motion to reconsider.
Could I go back to the fundamental question? The statute authorized supervised release. the judge ordered supervised release. So why is the statute unconstitutional?
The statute is not. It is only in this weird, unconsidered application that happens when it's not possible for the courts to get the county of Milwaukee or the state in Milwaukee County to follow the statute that it becomes unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional because it wasn't followed.
Right.
So that makes it unconstitutional? The question I have is that as I look at the facts, the halfway houses, they considered many of them. In fact, I think there were several that were looked at, but they felt that he was too dangerous. The halfway houses, made that decision. I think that I want you to correct me, the department was trying to find a place for Mr. Schulpius. Is that incorrect?
It is somewhat incorrect. And the reason it's somewhat incorrect is because if you look carefully in the record at what the halfway houses were saying, yes, they were saying he was too dangerous. They were also saying we're getting pressure from neighbors. And I think that determination he's too dangerous needs to be read in light of we're afraid to do this because we are afraid of having zoning problems. We are afraid of.
But the point I'm making or trying to make is that when we look at the statute is there. We know what Judge Franke did.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
He ordered release, supervised release. And the problem was that there was no place that would accept Mr. Schulpius. That is what, and the state could not find one other than to construct one. I mean, that's the way I look at this record.
Ms. Hennick, then follow up to Justice Crook's question. I want to ask about that. Under 980.08.
Wait a minute, Justice.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Answer Justice Crook's.
Ralph Wilcox.
I mean, Justice Wilcox, I apologize. I apologize.
We look so much alike.
I know.
You guys all look alike.
It's those little luncheons, I apologize. No.
Yeah. Just turn around the name tags.
Can't buy lunch. All right.
Justice Wilcox, I'm sorry after that exchange. I've kind of lost track. Can you try again?
I'll put my name. Here we go.
I believe you were.
Yeah, we were. I was asking about, you were talking about the statute and the unconstitutionality of it.
Okay.
I was talking about what happened in the case as I read the briefs, that the determination of dangerousness, I'm not talking about the psychiatrist talking about, the turndown of these halfway homes was done by the homes themselves, that the state was trying to place this person in a halfway house. And they weren't able to find one. And I believe they looked, because Judge Franke's order said not only in Milwaukee County, but all over. In fact, wasn't there one up in Pepin County? There was a home up there that was considered, but they got the same answer. So they looked not only in Milwaukee, but they looked other places.
I have a red light. May I answer?
Sure. You may answer.
Better.
Yeah.
First of all, in Pepin County, it was not the treatment facility that was turning them down. As a matter of fact, it was not initially the facility he was placed in that was turning him down. In fact, in Pepin County, it was the sheriff who decided that it ought to be turned down. I believe in Rock County, there was pressure put on by outside groups.
So you're saying the state might, so the state could have placed the person in Pepin County, but they listened to the sheriff. Is that what?
In part, the history of this case is we find a placement, we get it through the quiet part done by the department. Once it becomes public, we decide he's too dangerous. That's been the history of this case, if you look carefully.
Justice Butler.
Actually, my question has now been answered. Thank you.
Justice Prosser.
I think I asked you if there was a motion or petition to revoke, and I thought you said there wasn't. I'm looking at page 11 of your brief. On February 12, 1999, the state State filed an unsuccessful motion to reconsider disposition or petition to revoke supervised release.
Right. And what happened with that was that a determination was made by the judge that the appropriate route was reconsideration. It was never dealt with as a revocation.
Was that an error on the part of the judge?
Yes. If you apply Morford, it was.
Okay. But, I mean, it would be an error to say that you couldn't revoke somebody also, wouldn't it?
Yes. But you could have gone ahead and revoked him, but the procedures are different, and the findings that you would have to make are slightly different if this had been a revocation as opposed to a reconsideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hennick. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Orrin D. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Wisconsin, representing the state in this matter. I disagree that this is an as-applied challenge. And the reason is because when you look at the statute, every part of it was as-applied, and I did not hear what part of it was not. The statute requires the court to make a determination of whether or not the person is suitable for supervised release. Judge Franke did that. The statute requires the judge to order DHFS and the county of residence to come up with a release plan. Judge Franke did that. The DHFS and the county came up with numerous release plans. The statute gives the court discretion to approve the release plans. Judge Franke exercised his discretion and did not approve any of the release plans. The statute then requires the court to order the person released in accordance with the plan. Well, he can't do that until he approves a plan.
Why did he not approve the plans?
The reasons for those vary, and they're not particularly clear in the record. I think it's safe to say that a combination of private providers refusing for numerous reasons, one of which is their assessment of dangerousness. I think Ms. Hennick's assessment about their concern with their neighbors and zoning authorities is accurate. There is also a political problem in Milwaukee concerning supervised release, and it's not limited to Milwaukee, I think, as the sheriff of Pepin County demonstrates. But for all of those reasons,
he approved a plan and approved particular sightings. It's just that they didn't work out. Isn't that as good a way of stating the issue than the one you stated?
Yeah, it's an acceptable way, and it's also in keeping with Judge Franke's finding on the contempt proceeding. And it's important in that to understand that Judge Franke found that the state never will, DHFS, I have to make that distinction because we have the district attorney representing the state as an entity separate and apart from DHFS. And in this case especially, they didn't always agree. But Judge Franke found DHFS never willfully disobeyed any order, that the failure to comply with the orders was a combination of lack of resources and political problems.
Okay. So this statute that required release and required the plan was not put into effect because they couldn't find a place and they didn't put out money to build their own place, right?
I'm sorry, the last part?
The state did not put out funds to build a facility for him.
Well,
they could have bought a vacant lot, built a house, put a fence around it, put somebody in there, and supervised him. I mean, it's possible.
I'm not sure that's accurate.
Okay.
And in part, now this is a lot of this stuff's not in the record, unfortunately, because of the way the records are developed. But Judge Franke required Mr. Leanne, Secretary Leanne, to submit a letter to the legislature requesting appropriation, which that was the contempt finding.
Right.
Judge Leanne did that, and Judge Franke purged the contempt.
Right.
I believe as a result of that letter, the legislature did appropriate money for a halfway house to be built in Milwaukee County.
Has it been built?
No. And the reason is because politicians in Milwaukee County can't agree on a site.
So you have a statute that, in effect, is not being applied. It's not being applied because there is no way, apparently, to get supervised release in Milwaukee, at least for this man.
I would agree with you that the practical effect is that there's no, virtually no chance of supervised release in Milwaukee County. I would disagree with you that the statute's not being applied.
Yep. Counsel,
I think it is being applied.
Counsel, I think that the constitutionality of this whole scheme is in jeopardy. And it's in jeopardy because of, from one view, a charade, from another view, an inability because of local conditions and pressures to come up with what is required under the statute. So what, you know, as a minister of justice, you're with the Department of Justice, what are we to do about this as a court? I mean,
I have two responses.
You don't want us to find this unconstitutional.
And so, I don't think it's fair because, frankly, this problem is limited to Milwaukee County.
Well, Pippin County.
I can't talk about this based on the record, but there have been 39 people released on supervised release statewide. Nine of them have been discharged off of supervised release. But Ms. Hennick's correct that the only person released in Milwaukee County is Bill Morphy. So the problem, and frankly, I looked at the data the other day, the wait in Milwaukee County is three times where it is, with one exception, in any other place in the state. So it's not fair to say that the statute's not being applied or is unconstitutional beyond Milwaukee.
Just a minute. If we're dealing with this record, and it's the only record we have, I think it's fair to say in Pippin County it's not being applied. You have the sheriff say, hey, okay, there might be community placement. People might be willing to take them. But we have a population of 7,500. We're the second smallest community in the state, and we don't have nighttime law enforcement. That was the reason. So I assume that that's still the situation in the population of Pippin County, at least.
Counsel,
but the sheriff's specific objections were based on the particular plan for placement in Pippin County.
I would almost like to exclude everyone from here and have you tell me what we are to do. You don't want this found unconstitutional. Whether it's statewide or as to Milwaukee County's application, what are we to do?
In my view, this is not a problem that can be solved by this or any other court. It's a political problem, and it needs a political solution.
Well, we are guardians of the Constitution. Is a political solution realistic this year or next year?
But if you look at the analysis available to this court, the only one that fits is substantive due process. And I don't think under the United States Supreme Court's enunciation of what constitutes shocking the conscience or deliberate indifference, you can reach that result in this case.
I'm not sure, Mr. Weinstein. I can think of a number of judges whose conscience is shocked when their orders are not followed. But my question goes, and I want to find out, because you talked about Milwaukee County. What about chapter, and that was actually the question I was going to ask Ms. Hennick, section 980.08 sub 5 that allows the state to look outside of Milwaukee County. And as I understood Ms. Hennick's, one of her earlier answers, no one in Milwaukee County has been placed outside of the county either. So what's going on in Milwaukee that you can't find a placement either in Milwaukee or anywhere else in the state?
I can't answer that question because I don't know. I do know that in this case there were two out-of-county placements attempted, one of which was not very good, which is Pippin County. But the Rock County placement was with a reputable, normal halfway house. I don't know why that fell through. I can only guess, and I'd be happy to if you'd like me to. But I don't know why. I mean, there's a Court of Appeals decision that requires the judge to look statewide. So the law is clear on it. And why people are not doing that, I don't know.
Counsel, I want to ask a question.
Please.
Based on this case and what we have before us. It would seem to me, now we know what Judge Franke did, and he ordered supervised release, and as I read the record, that flew in the face, not saying it was right or wrong, but it flew in the face of the testimony of the various experts that said that Mr. Shopius was both dangerous and suffering from a mental illness at the time that release was ordered. Now, I don't want to ask you about the other 39. I don't know. But Judge Franke, if I understand this correctly, then came back and said, in more or less, I was trying to find the language here, but Judge Franke said, no, perhaps I was wrong. I don't want to put those words, but he said he was saying that he didn't agree with the experts, but ultimately he did. And he found Mr. Shopius dangerous. Mr. Shopius is presently up in, I think, Mauston, if I'm not incorrect, at this time.
Sandridge.
Sandridge. He's confined. So right now we're looking at a person who is is in treatment but has been diagnosed by every psychiatrist, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, that he is both dangerous and suffering from a mental illness. Is that correct?
Yes. Now, to be fair to Judge Franke, this was one of the early cases, and the expert testimony on dangerousness at the time that the testimony was taken in this case is not the same kind of testimony that he heard in November of 1999. The testimony in 1999 was that of Dr. Thornton, who is a renowned expert on sexual offending and treatment, who's now employed by the state. And he has developed various assessment tools for assessing persons not only on what he calls the static factors, which is past convictions and how the facts surrounding those convictions, but also on what he calls dynamic factors, which factor in how treatment affects the dangerousness of the given individual. His testimony in November of 99 and the psychiatrist who actually did the evaluation in either late 98 or 99 was that based on that model, Mr. Shopius was too dangerous to be released. And that's the testimony that convinced Judge Franke that at least at this point in time, Mr. Shopius is too dangerous to be released. One could debate about what the evidence showed back in 1996. And it was never tested on appeal because, of course, that's a non-final order, and we never got to a final order. So we came up before on a non-final order that dealt with ex post facto substantive due process and double jeopardy, which now is two of those have now been resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court adverse to Mr. Shopius. So we've never really had a testing of that. But to be fair with Judge Franke, I think maybe the testimony and the early testimony could have gone either way. But certainly the later testimony and the testimony that I think the finding that Judge Franke made in November was certainly based on credible testimony that Mr. Shilpius was too dangerous to release under any kind of supervision that Judge Franke could foresee. And I think that brings us to the question of, even if this conduct of failing to follow the court's orders, despite all the political problems and other things beyond DHFS's control, should result in Mr. Franke's release, or should he be left with his...
You mean Mr. Shilpius?
Yeah, Mr. Shilpius. Yeah. We're all getting names wrong.
No, we don't want that.
We're not that hard on the judge.
Yes. Or whether or not he should be left with his civil remedies.
Okay, I mean, now
he has a civil cause of action, either under Section 5161 or a 1983 claim.
What's that?
I'm sorry?
What is the civil cause of action? I mean, you're saying, well, maybe he should get a remedy because, after all, he's supposed to be released under the statute for whatever reason, political or otherwise, he's not being released, so don't release him, because the dilemma is you're releasing somebody who's been declared by some psychiatrist dangerous. So that is a dilemma for the court. And you know, on one hand, you have potential due process issues. You keep somebody 4 years contrary to the statute, contrary to the judge's order, and the state offers no solution for releasing him on just supervised release, right? That's where we are on that. Now, you say, okay, you can't release him because he's dangerous, but don't worry, Mr. Shilpius, we're going to give you a remedy. What's the remedy?
Well, if there's a violation of substantive due process, then he's entitled to damages under 1983.
And who does he get damages from?
I'm sorry?
Who does he get damages from?
Well, DHFS is the entity that held him.
And
so I think that DHFS would be the appropriate defendant.
No immunity?
I'm sorry?
No immunity from damages?
Well, if persons believe that not complying with the court order is conscience shocking sufficiently, it seems to me that there's at least a decent argument that DHFS should have known that, which would remove qualified immunity. They wouldn't be entitled to any absolute immunity, I don't think.
Counselor, how can you shock the conscience for a civil cause of action, but you can't shock the conscience to meet opposing counsel's claim that he's been denied substantive due process?
Well, I'm assuming, just for purposes of argument, that it is conscience shocking behavior and there is a constitutional violation. Then the question is the remedy release in this lawsuit? I agree with you that I'm not sure this is what you said, so let me start.
Well, your argument was contrary to what you'd made earlier, that there is no substantive.
I don't believe this is deliberate indifference, and therefore I do not believe this is conscience shocking behavior.
Right, and then you can't get to 1983.
And that would defeat a civil cause of action also. But if one assumes or believes that it is conscience-shocking behavior, I think the question of what the remedy is a separate question.
I see. Thank you.
Let me ask this, Mr. Weinstein, because part of the problem with the procedural posture in this case is you've got Chapter 980, a large portion of it being implemented in Milwaukee County with respect to the commitment side. But when it comes to the supervised release side, at least in Milwaukee County, as I understand it, it is not being implemented. Doesn't that really call into question, then, the operation of Chapter 980?
The problem I see with that view is that if supervised release is not required by the Constitution, and there's no...
But it's required by our statute.
It is required by the statute. So one could say the remedy for the statutory violation is to strike down the whole statute. I'm not sure that's... I don't know of any authority for that. Constitutionally, we could strike down the whole statute. And that's part of the problem. There doesn't seem to be, because of the political problem, I mean, you can't really fit this well into a legal a judicial kind of setting very well. With that part, I think we may both agree on. The problem here is not with the statute, how this court's interpreted the statute, or how the Court of Appeals has interpreted the statute, or even how Judge Franke interpreted the statute. The problem here is that
no one will obey our interpretation. That's the problem, isn't it?
Well, the political atmosphere is such that it's impossible for DHFS
Let me put it in a legal context. Where is your authority for saying that because there's a political problem, the state need not obey its own statute?
Well, I'm not.
Where is that a defense?
I'm not saying that in those words. What I'm saying is that if one cannot comply with a court order for reasons beyond the ability of DHFS, then you can't find DHFS in contempt. And as I read the United States Supreme Court decisions, that doesn't amount to deliberate indifference either, because Lewis, County of Sacramento versus Lewis, says that deliberate indifference it can be employed only when there's actual deliberation. And which it seems to me would mean that if DHFS cannot do what the court orders, it's not deliberating to avoid its order.
Can the state condemn property?
I'm sorry?
Can the state condemn property for building a halfway house?
I don't know the answer to that question. I suppose the legislature could pass a statute that would allow DHFS to
state purpose
to do it, but I don't know that there's any statutory provision.
What takes control, zoning or condemnation?
Well, I think this, again, the legislature has the authority and the power to negate any local zoning, but whether or not there's any statute that actually does that at this point in time.
It is state power to provide relief under a state.
The legislature certainly does, yes.
So what does the court do about that?
I'm sorry, and I could I'd amend it to go this far. I think perhaps if a judge exercised judicial power to do that, that might be sustained. But that never happened in this case.
And here, particularly, the judge found the other way. Looking at the efforts of the department, he chose not to find that for the department. Is that correct?
He chose to find the department was not in contempt, with the sole exception of requiring them to seek appropriations in the legislature.
Which Leon, yes. That was the yes. Letter from Leon, right?
One of the problems that I see from the exercise of judicial power is how do you get the people who actually make these decisions before the court, get the personal jurisdiction of them before the court? I mean, I'm not sure how you do that, but it may well be possible.
And when you say the exercise of judicial power, then you're talking about an order to show cause sort of thing?
Yeah, but the problem here is that the party before the court, which was DHFS, didn't have the ability to do what the court wanted done, which was condemn property. They could purchase property, but it was always scuttled one way or another.
And we had this very case, and Justice Wilcox wrote a very good opinion. Brilliant, I should say.
Thank you.
But we had the same issue. You know, this 1999 Sprosty. And what did Justice Wilcox say? He looked at the very statute that we have before us today, 980.08 sub 5. And it says, you know, the court shall order a placement plan, and DHFS shall come up with a placement plan. And if they can't come up with a placement plan in that county, they shall come up with another placement plan, and blah. And Justice Wilcox said, hey, look, the language of that statute is clear and unambiguous. The use of the word shall is mandatory. if DHFS is unable to arrange for a county to prepare a plan, this court shall designate and order a county through DHFS to prepare a plan and place the person on supervised release in that county. Isn't that what we have here? And haven't we said that in 1999? You made reference to there's some Court of Appeals opinions that say shall means shall in this context. We had the very issue. We laid out the groundwork, what has to be done, and yet it still isn't being done. With regard to that 4-year period at least, when he was ordered to be on supervised release and none was found and none was made.
Yes, I think perhaps that's what should have been done, but I can't tell you why it wasn't, but it wasn't.
We would hold the damages, suppose there were a damage claim. Who'd pay the damages?
I suspect the I don't know exactly how DOA operates this, but there is a risk management fund for things like that.
The state would pay it, the taxpayers.
Right. Yep.
Not the individuals involved here, not individuals in Milwaukee County that are objecting to this, not department people who haven't been successful.
Well, there is the ability to sue people in their individual capacities under 1983. I'm no 1983 expert, so I'm not sure I can answer all your questions, but there is at least theoretically, there is a possibility that a 1983 action could result in a judgment against an individual in their individual capacity that would not be the state's responsibility.
This is at least the second time, if I remember, that you have come up and said the remedy is sue us individually.
As
sue my clients.
As the state, yeah.
Sue my clients, right.
Are you thinking of Marbury?
I don't remember which case it is, but this is the same argument that you made. Sue my clients.
It wasn't me personally. Yes.
But could I ask you, if a person were sentenced to prison under a completely valid statute, and there was a mandatory release date, and the prison, for whatever reason, simply did not release the person at the mandatory release date, what is the violation? Is that a substantive or procedural, or what is the violation?
I think it's a statutory violation. And I think that I believe there is a case like this. And I think habeas was the remedy in that instance.
You said before that the state did not appeal Judge Franke's decision for supervised release because it was a non-final order. But you argued a case last term, the Burris case, in which Judge Welker ordered supervised release over the strong objection of the state, and the state did appeal to the Court of Appeals, and they did get a decision there. Why the inconsistency?
The difference is that Mr. Burris started out as a petition for supervised release under 980.08, which is a separate proceeding. This is one of the early cases in which the supervised release was ordered when we still had 980.06, and supervised release was an alternative to secure mental health facility commitment at the beginning. Mr. Burris, actually the same thing did happen with Mr. Burris, but Mr. Burris was placed and there was a final placement order, which brought up with it the non-final determination on whether or not he was appropriate for supervised release.
What about revocation in this case? In February of 99,
the department and the district attorney filed a petition for revocation. At that time, State versus Castillo was viable, which was the case that Morford disavowed. And under the law in Castillo, revocation didn't apply to Mr. Shilpius because he had not yet been released. Judge Franke relied on that decision and instructed this, denied the petition and told the state that in future that was not the appropriate vehicle. And that is why I disagree with Ms. Hennick on this also. The motion that was filed with Judge Franke was, in fact, an 80607 motion, and there was substantial body of law that supported that conclusion, all of which has now been disavowed by Marford. But at the time that that motion was litigated, that was the law. And the Court of Appeals had, on three occasions, interpreted motions to reconsider in the same type of situation as an 80607 motion.
Did this court make an incorrect decision in the Morford case on 80607?
I don't think so. I think that
some of us disagree.
Yeah. I realize that, but I didn't argue in favor of that position here.
In any case, your position is that 80607, even if that didn't apply as a result of Morford, because that was not appealed at the time, that you can't raise it now?
Well, I would, yes, I do make that argument. But I think, and this is getting into the retroactivity thing, which I believe this case is not a good vehicle for. But I believe that that kind of thing is one of the reasons that this court should not adopt the Harper view of the world, which the U.S. Supreme Court requires in its constitutional retroactivity jurisprudence. And it's because in civil cases, when people litigate on the law as it exists when they litigate it, to set that on its head and send a case back to start over again is going to be unfair to one or the other of the parties. And the same factors and dynamics that the Supreme Court relies on for its criminal jurisprudence in cases like Teague and Griffin versus Kentucky are different in the civil arena. And I think, on balance, Justice O'Connor's dissent in Harper makes more sense. And that's why I addressed that. But I think this is another area that I think I agree with Ms. Hennick on. The substantive due process aspect of this case makes the retroactivity aspect of it problematic, to say the least.
Mr. Weinstein, my understanding is that the Legislative Council is studying Chapter 980.
Yes, I believe there's a committee for that.
Where is that committee in its deliberations? Do you know?
I think they've had one meeting. Is that right? I'm not sure.
So it's very early.
Yes.
Do they have a set series of questions, or is it open-ended?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm not really up on it either.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Emmett?
Very quickly, on that committee, the committee that is meeting in Milwaukee County is created under 2003 Act 187. That committee was supposed to begin meeting to recommend sites in June. There was a fight over who belonged on the committee, to my understanding. That committee met for the first time either last week or the week before. My understanding was their meeting was simply preliminary. It's fairly clear to me, if you look at it realistically, they are supposed to make recommendations by the beginning of next year. I don't see any way that starting your committee now, you're going to have three sites picked out that you can recommend by the end of the year.
Three sites for what?
Three sites for possible building of a facility in Milwaukee County. That committee, the fact that there are recommendations does not guarantee that any of those would actually be chosen by the legislature or that the legislature would ever direct the building of it. And I think that's part of the problem here. We've talked about deliberate indifference in terms of what the department has done. But the truth is, the case here is state versus Mr. Schulpius, not the department. And the state clearly has not done anything. Secretary Leanne wrote So we know that they're on, that the legislature is on notice that there is a major problem here. He asked for authority to build. Nothing happened. The first thing you get is last spring's 2003 Act 187. And that doesn't say find a site and build. That says find a committee and think about it. According to Sandridge, there are likely to be about 20 additional people released or approved for supervised release in Milwaukee County in the next 5 years. The odds are there will still be no facility. Now, having said that, I also think that you have to be very careful going through the record in this case. In September of 97, we were informed by the department that residential placement cannot be accomplished in Milwaukee County because they have no residential facilities that will accept sex offenders. In February of 98, the sheriff of Pepin County complains about that placement. In October of 1999, Rock Valley Community Program, which is in a different county, is willing to accept him until the state, the town board, threatens to take away their license. In November of 1999, there is a two-bedroom apartment located, but the landlord backs out because of political pressures. In February of 1999, the reason that the department gives that they can't find placement is because private vendors are in jeopardy of losing their license if the communities get upset, and the Department of Corrections won't allow their halfway houses to be used because they don't want to have to deal with community notification.
Counsel, can I ask a question on release?
Sure.
People that are released are those that are, we're talking about supervised release, mm-hmm. are people that are not dangerous or that the department, let's say that the professional people would say would be able to flourish and function in a supervised capacity. What's the recommendation so far right now for your client?
I do not have any current information.
What's the last
it's not one? In my record.
What's the last one?
The last thing I have is from 2000, so that would be 4 years ago. It's been a significant amount of time. I do know that Mr. Schulpius has been in treatment during all of that time. He is not one of the people who has turned down treatment. That I know. So I do not know exactly what the status is currently. I do know that it is a misunderstanding to say that what we find is that people are not dangerous and don't have a mental illness. Those on supervised release are dangerous and do have a mental illness. There is simply a finding that they are not so dangerous that they need to be placed at Sandridge.
Has there ever been such a finding here?
That he is not that dangerous?
Right.
Certainly the initial finding was, yes.
And that was?
And that would have been, well, it depends on how you count it. Either in August of 1996, where there was some confusion about what the options were, but even there was not an order for supervised release. There was an order saying he should be placed in some other facility. We have since determined there is no other facility in a case called State v. Miller.
So is it fair to say that, at least at the last one, that he's been adjudged to be too dangerous to be treated in the community?
The last time there was a court hearing, his supervised release was reconsidered. Now, there's been substantial time since then. I am not aware. My understanding is that he had, because he was in treatment and he felt that he was making progress in treatment, he had an opportunity to petition the courts that he has not taken to this point. I don't know whether that's changed. That was the last time that I was aware of it, which was about 6 months ago. I did not double check at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you.
I see my time's up.
Thank you, Ms. Hennick, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for yet another argument in the Schulpius matter. That concludes our hearing on 02-1056, State versus Sean D. Schulpius. Thank you.